Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Anything's probably better than what state employees have right now.
A new bill in the legislature aims to bring back a pension system for public employees. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, March 3rd. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight on Kodiak Island, a village fights to keep its hydropower system running.
I mean, it's always something, and so just to be doing it this long and actually have next to no results is tough.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Grant applications are now being accepted for tribal justice grants through the U.S. Department of Justice. Coordinated Tribal Assistance Solicitation, or CETAS grants, fund tribal courts and tribal law enforcement, open to federally recognized tribes across Alaska. Applications are open until March 21st. Learn more at atjrc.org/CTAS. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tribal Justice Resource Center.
Alaska's state agencies are in the midst of an employment crisis, struggling to incentivize new hires and retain the staff they have. A report last year estimated 1 in 5 state jobs is vacant. A new bill introduced in the state Senate this week aims to address the shortage with a revamped retirement system. The current defined contribution or 401k style plan leaves employees to manage their own retirement account investments. Analysts say under this system, employees shoulder all the risk and often do not end up saving enough.
Employees were not earning enough through the defined contribution plan to actually retire with enough savings to support themselves.
That's Senator Kathy Geisel, an Anchorage Republican who introduced the new bill. Her bill would return public employees to a pension plan that would guarantee set payments upon retirement. There won't be a financial evaluation of how much the new bill costs the state until it's gone through the committee process, but Geisel says she expects it will be, quote, very affordable.
If we can more effectively retain our state employees, keep those skilled people in their jobs, it makes a huge cost savings for the state. And not only that, it serves the Alaska public much better.
One of the ways lawmakers are proposing to keep the new pension system lean is by not offering health benefits upon retirement. Jeff Casper, business manager for the Alaska Public Employees Association, says that's not ideal, but returning to a pension plan has been the union's number one goal.
Anything's probably better than what state employees have right now.
Geisel's bill has to move through 2 committees before it gets to the Senate floor. It will likely face an uphill battle in the conservative majority House, but Geisel says she's hopeful she and other proponents will be able to rally support. The village of Yuzinki on the Kodiak Archipelago recently replaced its hydropower system, but it's taken the village more than 2 years to get there. And as KMXT's Kirsten Dobroth reports, it comes as more remote communities in Alaska are eyeing their own transition to renewables.
As of late last month, the village of Yuzinki has a new hydropower system that provides the bulk of energy for the village of 130 people. But getting there wasn't easy. The story starts back in the 1980s. That's when the village's hydropower system was first installed. It worked, but it had issues and was only running at about 50% of its overall capacity. And then, in November of 2019, it failed altogether, a month after Elijah Jackson was sworn in as mayor. He says the city immediately started securing grants to fix the system.
And then COVID came and just stopped everything.
Parts were hard to find because of supply chain issues, and it was nearly impossible to fly people into the village because of the pandemic. The scope of the project also changed and grew as time went on, and more people and equipment were needed for the ballooning scale of the work. Jackson says in the midst of the project, the plant's newly installed main water line called a penstock failed. It's the main water line for the whole system.
And this line didn't last 2 years. It broke down in 1.5 years. 6 months out of our warranty.
Yuzinki had secured a $2.8 million grant to install the penstock, but it also took out a 40-year loan with the U.S. Department of Agriculture for more than $460,000 for that specific part. Tyler Cornelis is the Economic Development and Environmental Programs Manager at the Kodiak Area Native Association. He helped with the grant hunting process for Yuzinki's hydropower system and agrees that timing was a big hurdle.
There's supply chain challenges. There's engineers that are overworked and under available in the state. So just lining up the right people to get the job done has been a challenge.
The village had to use diesel generators to keep the lights on, but Jackson says they were hemorrhaging money to keep up with the fuel bills. Jackson says they owe more than $100,000 to the Yuzinki Native Corporation for fuel payments. Jackson's been reluctant to raise rates on residents. He says a short-term fix has been for staff to take on 3 to 4 jobs to cut costs. In his case, that means he's also the village public safety officer, and a lot of sleepless nights in the meantime.
I have contractors and state employees calling me evenings, weekends, you know, just nonstop holidays about, oh, we're coming in, this is happening, or you guys need to fill this out. Or, I mean, it's always something. And so just to be doing it this long and actually have next to no results is tough. It's like running and just pushing a wall that's not moving nonstop, you know.
According to the U.S. Department of Energy, roughly 140,000 Alaskans depend on isolated electric grids, and those power sources typically come from burning fossil fuels. But that's changing, thanks in part to an influx in federal funds from the bipartisan infrastructure law that incentivizes renewables.
There's going to be a lot more opportunities for rural Alaskan communities to take advantage of local renewable energy resources.
Chris Rose is the executive director of Renewable Energy Alaska Project, which promotes the development of renewable energy in the state. He says Alaska is positioned to be an international leader to provide developing parts of the world a model to use as more remote communities develop their own renewable microgrids. The city of Kodiak, for example, is almost entirely reliant on renewable energy for its electricity. But Rose says designing a self-contained power system for a small community that's off the road system, like Yuzinki, is challenging. So is the upkeep.
It's not just money that we have to have. We need to, you know, we need project managers that are trusted and can help a community.
The most successful projects typically have what he calls a local energy champion. That's someone in the community who's keeping an eye on training opportunities for staff to maintain the project, or someone who understands how to tap into programs to bring down rates for residents. And just as important, according to Rose, is connecting with other communities that have had similar growing pains.
Knowledge sharing is really important. There's really no reason why every community has to go through this for the first time and have the same kind of issues that maybe another community already learned from.
Yuzinki didn't quite have the luxury to plan for all of this since its energy system failed suddenly right before the pandemic. But Jackson says he's reluctantly taken on the role of energy champion since then.
I love challenges. You know, I also didn't know when I was elected mayor, it makes you utility manager here too. So it's been a huge learning curve, and I definitely had no idea what to do during a pandemic. Very humbling experience this has been. So
he says he hasn't found any grants to help chisel away at the village's outstanding fuel bills, but he's hoping lower energy rates will help pay off the debt. And most importantly, give people a reason to stay in the village long term. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, from trail conditions to this year's lineup, everything you need to know for the Iditarod.
Just imagine a washboard, except every ridge in the washboard is 4 feet wide and 6 feet wide, 8 feet wide.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's three universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Members of the Anchorage Assembly are calling for the vice chair of a municipal advisory commission to resign after he brought up stereotypes about people who experience homelessness. Alaska Public Media's Jeremy Shea reports.
The comments under scrutiny were made during a meeting on Wednesday of the Housing, Homeless, and Neighborhood Development Commission. The body advises the city's elected leaders on a wide range of topics related to housing and homelessness. Commissioner Jim Crawford was floating ideas for where to look for money for programs to address homelessness. Crawford conflated race and mental illness and suggested they cause homelessness.
If in the event that homelessness is caused by mental deficiency in our Native communities, then that should establish the priorities of where to get the money.
Alaska Natives are greatly overrepresented among people in Anchorage experiencing homelessness. But, backed by research, public health authorities like the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention see racism and its various effects as a cause of disparities like this rather than race itself. Anchorage Assemblymember Felix Rivera highlighted Crawford's comments during a meeting he chaired on Thursday, calling them appalling and racist.
This statement has no place in our discourse around homelessness. For my part, I am sick, literally, and tired of how the Alaska Native community is treated as a punching bag on this topic.
Rivera said the comments perpetuate stereotypes and stigma. He demanded Mayor Dave Bronson's administration investigate, seek Crawford's resignation, and better vet its appointees. Through a spokesperson in an email, Bronson said he disagrees with Crawford's statement and that, quote, mental illness crosses all boundaries of race, ethnicities, and economic status. He said he will continue fighting to help the city's most vulnerable people. The mayor's office did not address Rivera's demands. Crawford, reached Thursday evening, says he has no intention of resigning. He says he did not intend to bring up Alaska Natives.
If I said Alaska Natives, I don't have any explanation for that because I don't recall making the statement. Maybe I did. If I did, it was a mistake.
Instead, he says he was focused on the prevalence of mental illness among the homeless population and was suggesting the city tap the resources of the Alaska Mental Health Trust. Current service provider data for Anchorage does show about 38% of all clients in the system reported having a condition that qualifies them for services paid for by the Mental Health Trust. The trust covers people with a wide range of conditions, from Alzheimer's to alcoholism to anxiety disorders. Rivera says if the administration doesn't take any action, he may formally request a written response. In Anchorage, I'm Jeremy Shea.
And the city of Anchorage faces more than $600,000 in fines from the state agency in charge of workplace health and safety, with the potential for tens of thousands more in fines. But city officials say they've addressed most, if not all, of the concerns laid out by the state. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early has more.
Mayor Dave Bronson and the Anchorage Assembly received an 88-page letter from the Alaska Occupational Safety and Health Enforcement Section, or Alaska OSHA, late last month. The letter says the city had been labeled as a, quote, severe violator by Alaska OSHA last year and had entered an informal settlement with the state to resolve more than two dozen health and safety citations from 2021. During an assembly work session Thursday regarding the letter, Assembly Chair Suzanne LaFrance described it as concerning.
This is very alarming and worrisome. I mean, I want people to be safe, and then I also don't want to be spending money on citations that could have been prevented.
The settlement lowered the total number of fines from about $627,000 to $92,000, contingent on the city resolving those issues and hiring a contractor to take a look at overall workplace safety in Anchorage. The state doesn't believe the city has adequately addressed the issues. The citations went back to the administrations of mayors Ethan Berkowitz and Dan Sullivan and ranged from a lack of guardrails in some facilities and workers being exposed to electrical hazards to workplace injuries not being reported on time. The letters says that if the city doesn't resolve the issues and hire a contractor, the full fine could be reinstated, plus a more than $14,000 fine per day per citation not addressed. City attorneys say the city has sent information to the state over the course of the last year detailing how each citation was resolved. Municipal manager Kent Colhase told assembly members that the city was surprised at the letter.
We believe that many of the items in the letter have actually been resolved, and we are working with the safety managers at the various departments to collect that documentation.
Additionally, Colhase says the city has hired a contractor to address safety concerns who began working last week, the same week the letter was sent. Alaska OSHA officials did not respond to a request for comment. City officials say they're compiling reports from various departments to present to the state showing that they addressed the citations. They plan to make the information available to the assembly and the public as well. Member Meg Zalatel asked that it be available as early as next week, in part to assure the community that the city is operating safely.
We are having significant issues with our municipal workforce, and this doesn't help us recruit or retain additional workforce. So it has been taken care of. We want to get this out into the public to reassure folks that the municipality is a safe place to work.
The assembly approved a $14,000 contract last month to hire the contractor, though city officials say it could cost a minimum of $60,000 more for the contractor to adequately meet the requirements of the settlement with Alaska OSHA. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Grant applications are now being accepted for tribal justice grants through the U.S. Department of Justice. Coordinated Tribal Assistance Solicitation, or CETAS grants, fund tribal courts and tribal law enforcement, open to federally recognized tribes across Alaska. Applications are open until March 21st. Learn more at atjrc.org/CTAS. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tribal Justice Resource Center.
Not yet a member of this station? Well, today is a perfect day to become one. You simply make a donation. It's that simple.
The Juneau School District lost nearly $270,000 to a scammer posing as a vendor last year. According to city staff, they haven't taken the necessary steps to recoup the loss, but district leaders say those decisions are still in progress. KTOO's Katie Anastas has more.
City Finance Director Jeff Rogers outlined the incident in a memo shared with the Assembly Finance Committee. He said someone claiming to be one of the district's vendors asked to change their banking information. The scammer used a spoof email address that varied slightly from the vendor's real address. At the Assembly Finance Committee meeting Wednesday night, Rogers said it's a well-known strategy.
This particular scheme is very common. You can't listen to a webinar about fraud. You can't go to a financial conference. You can't step out your front door without hearing that this is really a very successful method for fraudsters to use, which is to call and say, I represent a vendor and I want you to change my banking instructions.
The city recommends that staff contact vendors separately to verify requests like these. But school district staff didn't do that, Rogers wrote. The scammer stole more than $93,000 in October and more than $175,000 in November. The school district became aware of the theft in early December, but by then it was too late to recover the funds. Scammers used a similar method to steal more than $329,000 from the city in 2019. The city has a risk fund for these kinds of incidents and could cover much of the district's loss. But according to Rogers, the Juneau School District hasn't filed a claim with the CBJ risk manager or the city's third-party insurers.
I know that there has been communication from the CBJ risk manager to the school district, and there has not been communication back.
But Juneau School District Superintendent Bridget Weiss says she has communicated with the city. She says she told CBJ in mid-February that the school board would discuss potential insurance claims in executive session at its March 7th meeting. She says the district received Rogers' memo shortly before the Finance Committee meeting began.
I think that we have been in contact. Have we made all the final decisions related to this? We have not. And the board has a planned executive session on Tuesday to have this very conversation. And that was scheduled when Jeff Rogers submitted his memo to the assembly.
Rogers says city leaders have asked the district to make the public aware of the incident since mid-December. But Weiss says the district was waiting for more information from the investigation, which is still ongoing.
We very much work hard as a district and a school board in being transparent. We wanted to make sure we had all the information that we could have, because then we can share more publicly if we know exactly what happened and what can be shared.
Weiss says the attack was external and not from someone within the district. She says the district requires annual cybersecurity training and is reviewing its protocol. Wednesday's Assembly Finance Committee meeting also included a discussion of the school district's request for additional funding from the city. The committee moved the request to the full assembly for a final decision. In Juneau, I'm Katie Anastas.
The Canadian Yukon Quest organization is reflecting on a mandatory rest system piloted in races in the Yukon Territory last month. The longest, a 450-miler from Whitehorse to Dawson, required a total of 34 hours rest. That's 20 hours more than was required in the Yukon Quest Alaska 550. Yukon Quest International Association Canada Operations Manager John Hopkins Hill says the intent was to raise the floor of dog care, and added that Quest 450 mushers had some flexibility where they took their breaks.
Of those 34 hours, they were required to take one mandatory six-hour stop at either the Braeburn or Carmax checkpoint, and that was in order to ensure that they could have the vet check that was also a requirement of our rules. And the remaining 28 hours for 450 mushers, they could take those anywhere else they wanted along the way.
Hopkins Hill says rest taken outside of checkpoints was tracked via GPS and mushers' notes, and he says all mushers ended up taking more than the required rest.
All the mushers we spoke to said that it was fair to say that this mandatory rest did not have any impact on race plans or the outcome of the race or race strategy, which is really a delicate balance.
Hopkins Hill emphasizes that the mandatory rest system was an experiment, and whether it's used again next year will hinge on additional analysis and feedback from mushers. The 2023 Iditarod kicks off Saturday with a ceremonial start in Anchorage, followed by an official race restart in Willow. From there, 33 mushers and hundreds of sled dogs will make the 1,000-mile dash to Nome. It's the smallest group of teams in the Iditarod's history, but it's a pretty competitive one. And here to tell us about it is Alaska Public Media's Lex Trinan, who will be following the teams out on the trail. Hi, Lex.
Hey, Casey.
All right, first of all, when does the Iditarod actually start?
The race begins with a parade-like ceremonial start in Anchorage on Saturday, March 4th, so tomorrow, starting at 10 a.m. They'll take off one by one every couple of minutes from 4th Avenue near D Street. This portion of the run, the first day, isn't timed. It's really just a way for the mushers and teams to show off for the crowds. They'll head down some city streets and onto the trails and end at Campbell Airstrip, so you can catch them at a few spots around town, and you can check our website for details on that. After the ceremonial start on Sunday, mushers and their dog teams will drive to Willow for the official start. That is at 2 p.m. on Willow Lake. They'll again leave at 2-minute intervals and head off to Nome.
Yeah, and like you said, there's a bunch of information at our website, alaskapublic.org/Iditarod. I even saw in one of the stories that's already there a map of the route this year. Tell me about the route that the Iditarod Trail is following this year.
Right, so it's 2023, an odd year, so they will be taking the southern route, but they haven't taken that route since 2019 because of COVID-19 closures. The southern route is slightly longer and is thought to be more challenging, with a few extra mountains and a lot of mushing on the exposed Yukon River. It hits a few new villages as well, like Shagluck, Anvik, and Grayling. And just to be clear, most of the trail is the same, but there's just a section of a couple hundred miles that is different than last year's competition.
Yeah, no doubt. How about the trail itself? Have you heard much about the trail conditions?
I did get to sit down and talk with race director Mark Norman, and he says the trail in general is pretty good. He says heavy snow that hit south central Alaska holds up pretty well through a Rainy Pass Lodge. That's about 150 miles into the race. From there, the teams tackle the Dalzell Gorge. It's a twisty trail marked by a series of steep downhills and some very tight turns. But things are pretty good there, according to Norman. But then things get tough. Nordman says the route from Rhone to Nikolai has among the worst moguls in race history.
Just imagine a washboard, except every ridge in the washboard is 4 feet wide and 6 feet wide, 8 feet wide, and 2, 3, 4 feet deep. So it's just this up and down, up and down. Dogs do fine on it. It's hard on mushers, hard on racers.
Once the mushers hit the coast, there may be a little bit of rerouting. Traditionally, teams go across the ice on Norton Sound and Golovin Bay, but Nordman says there was some low ice coverage on some of those sections. He says it's unclear if mushers will travel over the ice or take an overland route around it. It's not a big deal for the race either way. It's happened before, but Nordman says they're keeping an eye on it.
So there are just 33 teams signed up this year, though, and that's the lowest number in race history. What can you tell us about that?
Well, the low field size is a big topic of discussion in the mushing community right now. A lot of mushers are talking about how the rising price of dog food is affecting their ability to race. The price of a bag of kibble has basically doubled in the last couple of years, they tell me. Some mushers want to see the prize purse increase as well. It's shrunk substantially in the last 15 years, even without inflation. They say more prize money means more mushers are incentivized to run. And the Iditarod also says it's working on some ways to grow the next generation of mushers. Next year is going to run a shorter junior race alongside the 1,000-mile Iditarod, and it's looking into running a shorter mid-distance race as well. That would be maybe around 300 miles. Those sorts of mid-distance races have remained popular even as the Iditarod field size has shrunk over the last decade.
Yeah, and just to mention, you've done some reporting on all of that. There's a larger story about that at alaskapublic.org/Iditarod. We also have stories there, you know, from the past few years, which of course have been marked by COVID-19 protocols in the Iditarod. So just to be clear, are there any COVID-19 protocols this year?
I mean, no, the vaccine requirement has dropped. The testing requirement has dropped as well. So basically, no, there's no more COVID precautions this year. All the checkpoints that had been closed down the last couple of years are open again. And the only effect, I guess you could say, is that there will be an epidemiologist out on the trail in case of any COVID-19 infections that are caught out there.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, we said it before, and I'll say it again. You can find all of our Iditarod content at alaskapublic.org/Iditarod. You can also sign up for our Iditarod newsletter. And definitely check out our Iditapod podcast. You can find that wherever you listen to podcasts. Lex will be on there later. Our other trail reporter, Ben Matheson, will be as well. And Lex, as far as this goes, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Casey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Kavitha George, Jeremy Shea, Wesley Early, and Lex Trinan in Anchorage, Kirsten Dobroth in Kodiak, Katie Anastas in Juneau, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Madeline Rose is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. If you would like to play an integral part in what you're listening to, public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. If you are already a member or corporate sponsor, thank you. If you'd like to learn more about how to become a member or sponsor, it's easy. Start with a call to your public radio station. Planned gifts as a bequest to your local station builds a legacy that is long-lasting. Thanks for considering this option. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.